In a lecture delivered at the Collège de France on January 21st, 1976, nearly 25 years ago, and entitled Society Must Be Defended, Michel Foucault seeks to develop, beyond a theory of sovereignty, an analysis of what he calls relations or operators of domination. Structures of power that, working as global strategies that traverse and use local tactics of domination, deploy heterogeneous techniques and technologies of domination that guarantee their function. These would form, in the words of Jean Paulhan, to whom I will turn later, a complex grammar, a grammar of war that in its turn acts as a kind of matrix for techniques of domination. This is why Foucault asks, if we look beneath peace, order, wealth, and authority, beneath the calm order of subordinations, beneath the state and state apparatuses, beneath the laws, and so on, will we hear and discover a sort of primitive and permanent war? Can the phenomena of war be regarded as primary with respect to other relations, relations of inequality, dissymmetries, divisions of labor, relations of exploitation, etc.? We must ask, he goes on to say, if military institutions and the practices that surround them, and in more general terms, all the techniques that are used to fight a war, are, whichever way we look at them, directly or indirectly, the nucleus of political institutions. If, that is, an uninterrupted battle shapes peace, is always beneath the surface of peace. Inverting Clausewitz's famous formulation that war is no more than a continuation of politics by other means, he states that politics is the continuation of war by other means. Suggesting that this turn corresponds to the appearance of a discourse on war as the basis of all relations and institutions of power, a turn he also associates with the emergence of the army as an institution, with the moment when the state is endowed with military institutions that replace both the day-to-day and generalized practice of warfare, and a society that was perpetually traversed by relations of war, he claims that this moment symptomatically emerges at the end of the civil and religious wars of the 16th century, and that political power does not begin when the war ends. War is not averted, but rather presides over the birth of states. Right, peace, and law, he writes, were born in the blood and mud of battles. Law is not pacification, for beneath the law, war continues to rage in all mechanisms of power. In the smallest of its cogs, peace is waging a secret war. To put it another way, we have to interpret the war that is going on beneath peace. Peace itself is a coded war, end quote. I have wanted to begin with this lecture in order to suggest that this discourse of perpetual war forms part of the complex grammar against which Kant writes his remarkably enduring 1795 essay, Toward Eternal Peace, even though he himself registers on several fronts his inability to exceed this grammar. That this question of codification is a question of a grammar, of a language, is confirmed beyond my reference to Paulhan in a remarkable little text by Roland Barthes, published in 1957 and entitled African Grammar. Emphasizing the ways in which official French reports on African affairs function not as communication, but as intimidation, often employing the signature tactic of bourgeois ideology, that is, naming something by its opposite, he writes, guerre, war. The goal is to deny the thing. For this, two means are available. Either to name it as little as possible, the most frequent procedure, or else to give it the meaning of its contrary, the more cunning procedure, which is at the basis of almost all the mystifications of bourgeois discourse. War is then used in the sense of peace, and pacification in the sense of war, end quote. This identification between war and peace has, as Foucault suggests, a long history, and it is signaled again in the book that Winston Smith reads in George Orwell's 1984 before being arrested by the character Emmanuel Goldstein, the state-manufactured enemy of the people, who in the third chapter of his Theory and Practice of Oligarchical Collectivism states, a peace that was truly permanent would be the same as a permanent war. This is the inner meaning of the party slogan, war is peace, end quote. It is easy to register that Kant is one of the great readers of the complicity between war and peace. And indeed, throughout his treatise, he suggests the difficulty of overcoming this couple, even as he continues to delineate what for him could offer the chance of instituting peace, if not without violence, at least with the least violence possible. taking his point of departure from Leibniz's 1693 Codex Juris Gentium Diplomaticus, in which, in the opening paragraph of his introduction to this collection of documents, Leibniz makes reference to the image of a graveyard above which are written the words Pax Perpetua, Kant opens his treatise with this famously enigmatic but striking passage, suggesting that the inevitable destination of peace is death itself. Toward eternal peace. Whether this satirical superscript on that Dutch innkeeper's sign upon which a graveyard was painted is valid for human beings in general, or especially heads of state, who can never get enough of war, or perhaps only for philosophers who dream that sweet dream, is not up to us to decide. But the author of the present treatise situates himself in this way. Since the practical politician places the theoretical one at his feet, looking down with great self-satisfaction and regarding him as an academic, who with his ideas devoid of reality brings no danger to the state, which must proceed from principles of experience, and whom one can always allow to fire his 11 projectiles all at once without the world-wise statesman having to turn around, in case of a conflict with a theoretical politician, the practical one must proceed in a consistent manner and not suspect a danger to the state behind the opinions that the latter openly expresses and ventures in the hope that they would meet with good luck. By this clausula salvatoria, the author will herewith know himself expressly guarded in the best form against all malicious interpretation. As Greg said, it's always a matter of translation. If Kant places a sign of death and loss at the beginning of his treatise, he also suggests an interpretation of his philosophical project that guarantees, or at least claims to presume, its failure. Toward Eternal Peace, in other words, is written not only under the sign of failure, but as Peter Fenves has argued, under the protection of failure as well. By claiming to fail, the treatise guards itself against those in power who might fear its success. As long as the project Kant proposes in Toward Eternal Peace is understood as nothing more than a sweet dream, as long as it is understood as a failure from the start, there can be no objection to its publication. According to the premises of those who review the publication of philosophical treatises, Toward Eternal Peace does not apply to the real world. This is in Kant's interest, since he also hints that thinking here finds its strength in its own impotence. If he seems to be launching, however discreetly, a war between politician and theorist, it is in order to avert the assaults which theorizing peace ineluctably attracts. In fact, Kant's tact in the opening of his essay is to ensure that his text remains immune to criticism and censure. As Avital Ronell has noted, he sends out antibodies to neutralize the war utterance of the political body. For in times of trouble, and thinking's business concerns making trouble by responding authentically to trouble, the political body always sends in troops to subdue the critical intervention that true philosophical mobilization must contemplate. Kant allows himself to fire his entire volley because they are blanks. They are the stuff of dreams and address themselves to what does not exist in the present. Because the theorist is fundamentally disarmed by the state and barred by the nature of philosophizing from producing a referential dent in policy, the politician will have to desist from waging war or polemics on theoretical activity. What the essay makes clear from its very beginning, then, is that the state claims indifference to theoretical reflection, even as it threatens it with reprisal for betraying the interests of national security. Far from granting access to eternal peace, Kant's opening words articulate the impasse on the way toward this long-sought destination, and they do so by indicating the difficulty of reading the sign after which the treatise is named. If the sign is meant for human beings in general, they should seek peace in the grave. If it is meant for heads of state, they should see the grave as the result of their insatiable desire for war. If it is meant for philosophers, they should emerge from their dreams and awaken to the reality of interstate conflict. By placing directions over an emblem, the innkeeper produces something like a signpost for those who seek the road to peace. But insofar as this sign says to those for whom it is valid that there is no peace in this life, it is, in Fenves' words, a self-negating sign. If, however, a sign does not give directions, then it is not simply a sign, but the replacement for an absent sign. And in the case of the sign posted by the innkeeper, the absence of a directional sign presents itself in an image of irreparable loss. The gravestones to which a graveyard is recognizable are themselves signs by which the end of life's road is marked and a means of preserving and memorializing the loss of life in perpetuity. The sign suggests that there is no path to peace. If there is no path to peace, there can be no method by which this goal can be secured, and if it is understood in advance that no method is valid, then no proposal for peace poses any danger. The sign is therefore a sign of the missing sign giving directions to the place called eternal peace. Once toward eternal peace has been placed under this sign, Kant can raise a general question of validity. Under what conditions can a genuine peace treaty take place and have authority? And this is precisely the question to which he responds in the first article of the treatise when he states, "No conclusion of peace shall be valid if it is made with a secret reservation of the material for a future war, since in this instance, peace would be a mere truce, a postponement of hostilities, no peace." As Kant tells us, peace means the end of all hostilities, and to attach to it the adjective eternal is a pleonasm that at once arouses suspicion. Quote. In other words, a peace treaty would be self-annulling insofar as its reason for existing is finite and not infinite. A true peace treaty would constitute a war on war and therefore would suspend its function as a mere contractual deal amongst nations. A contract, as Benjamin will later point out in his Critique of Violence, always implies its own suspension or a return to violence in the event that one of the parties should fail to honor its terms. A contract or treaty, therefore, belongs to the pervasive logic of war, offering little to affect the disinstallation of war in our history. Here, a question concerning the validity of a sign gives way to a question concerning the validity of peace treaties in general. But this question itself is a generalization of the aporia to which the sign points. And this aporia is inscribed in the very term for peace, Friedensschluss, conclusion of peace. Kant doubtless means by this word a treaty by which war comes to a conclusion, but it could also mean the exact opposite, peace's conclusion, an end to peace, and thus the inception of war. A peace treaty can be guaranteed, but not its eternality. Unless a peace treaty is eternal, however, it not only does not establish peace, but on the contrary, it prolongs the war. In Kant's words, a peace treaty puts an end to a particular war, but not to the state of war, which consists in finding ever new pretexts for starting a new one, end quote. This prolongation of war is also due, as he says later in the treatise, to acts of warfare that make mutual confidence impossible in time of future peace, such as the employment of assassins, the violation of articles of surrender, or the instigation of treason in the state against which a state is making war, end quote. Once brought into use, he goes on to say, these dishonorable stratagems do not stay within the limits of war, but are continued in time of peace, and thus the purpose of peace is completely frustrated, end quote. This is why what is at stake for him is the possibility of a union, a federalism of free states, which would be distinguished from a peace treaty by the fact that the latter tries to end merely one war, while the former tries to end all wars forever, end quote. As he suggests, however, such a scheme that in Peter Zendi's words would have a certain efficiency, would place the possibility of peace under the legal and executive sovereignty of the same historical powers that compromise it. Peace is thus de facto made dependent on a particular, that is, alien power to guarantee it, and is thus exposed to the arbitrary will and the special interests of this power, even when it proclaims itself to represent a regulative idea of humanity. The efficiency of eternal peace cannot prevent, in other words, its own use toward the destruction of this same peace, which is why the treatise can always only move toward eternal peace without ever realizing it. In a little text entitled Letter on Peace and written in 1949, Poulenc reinforces this point by suggesting, perhaps with more force than Kant, that peace exists only in the service of war. Indeed, the third section of his letter is entitled simply, "Whoever wants peace prepares for war." If he opens his text by proclaiming, "It is true that I desire peace, as does everyone else, but I desire it timidly, and if I can say so, secretly. When I hear the brave Mr. Phillips state that this peace is a question of life or death for us, or the excellent Mr. Spock during a fine declamation, 'We want peace and we will not let ourselves be attacked by anyone,' or else the delightful Paul Eloy, 'We are fighting against war,' I am embarrassed. They are right, of course. Yet it seems to me that peace is driven off by battles, by questions of life and death, by fine declamations, who knows, perhaps even by speeches. It is because he suggests that there is a grammar of ideas that ensures the constant turning of peace into war, and to such an extent that neither one can ever appear without the other. As he puts it, and I quote the passage in its entirety, "The authors, and there is no shortage of them, of treatises on perpetual peace, clearly stumble on the difficulty. If you desire peace, begin by waging war. Henry IV, and later on the good Father Guthrie, want to bring peace to Europe. Listening to them, it would be enough for Christians to get along together. First, chase out the Turks, exterminate them if necessary. However, Leibniz, or the Abbé de Saint-Pierre, dream instead of a holy alliance among monarchs. And if some sovereign refuse to join, or some people refuse to follow its sovereign, they will soon be made to see reason. Funny, this language in which war is called reason." Later on, Kant, Anatole France, or Romain Rolland will go as far as peace for the entire world. "All that has to be done," they say, "is once and for all to win the nations over to a political system in which each subject is a citizen, to impose it on them if necessary. But this won't happen without battles." Don't be too surprised at that. We're living in a world where the word peace, if it is said with even a grain of authority, means pretty much, "I'm going to smack you." But do we have to go and consult writers? It's enough for me to observe the parties in the various governments. Scarcely had the Reformation proposed to go back to the peace of primitive Christianity when it began to soak Germany and Europe with blood. The French Revolution had only to declare peace to the entire world before it saw itself forced to wage 20 years of war. Not only this, but they created for that war the most pitiless army system ever conceived, compulsory military service. The Tsar had no sooner established his court of peace than he began to fight. And we all know how the League of Nations ended up. The least you can say is that it came to a bad end. Every era has excellent minds that try to research where wars come from. The answer is simple. They come from the dogged passion for making peace treaties that every now and then overcome men. All these people who talk about peace are thinking only about our blood. I said just now, and it is all too obvious, that peace finds questions of life and death, battles, fine declamations, political speeches, repellent. More, it is quite possible that it is repulsed by desire itself and clear reflection. Whoever strongly desires peace is already clenching his fists. Whoever steadily craves it creates a war machine. We're living through singular times where each individual firmly believes there is no illness of society or of the mind that resists knowledge or the illumination of its motivating forces that resists the full light of day. Everyone believes this. And no one can say that the results of this are very happy. But what if the opposite were true? What if there existed evils that come from too much light and thoughts that have to be made a little dimmer to give themselves fully? If there were really only one hope for peace, that it be silent rather than expressed and somehow prayed for rather than demonstrated, it would already be an important result of the grammar of which I spoke to you if it led us to this discovery, end quote. Beginning from the presumption of the inevitable complicity between peace and war, Poulon suggests that we should pay more attention to the way in which the idea or grammar of peace is always instrumentalized in the direction of war, and that in doing so, we might reap at least a small benefit. Walter Benjamin already had made this point in a remarkable but almost entirely neglected and unfinished little text written in 1926 and entitled Peace Commodity. The text is a somewhat ruthless and sarcastic attack on Fritz von Unruh's attempt to sell peace across Europe in the aftermath of the First World War. A general's son, von Unruh, was an officer in the German army until 1912, when he left to pursue his writing career. His books were presumably anti-militaristic and called for war, peace, and brotherhood, and Benjamin refers particularly to his 1925 Winds of Nike, which is an account of his efforts to move people toward peace. Benjamin opens his brief text by noting that from 1920 to 1923, in Rome, Zurich, and Paris, German products could be found for half the price that one would usually have paid for the same goods abroad, or indeed in Germany itself. Poorly assembled goods for an impoverished population who were no longer capable of normal consumption were thrown into what he calls the dumping ground of the inflation era and placed on the European market as peace commodities at bargain prices. Suggesting that these peace commodities included, among other things, Kant's Toward Eternal Peace, he writes, "Around that time, the barriers began to lift again, and the traveling salesmen set off on tour. One had to live on clearance sales, and the higher the dollar rose, the greater was the circulation of export goods. At the height of the catastrophe, it included intellectual and cultural goods, too. For even if the financial benefit was smaller, turnover raised the prestige of the entrepreneur. The Kantian idea of eternal peace, long undeliverable in a spiritually bankrupt Germany, was right in the first ranks of those spiritual export articles. Uncheckable in its manufacture, a slow seller for the previous 10 years, it was available at unbeatable prices. It was a heaven-sent opportunity to smooth the way for more serious export. No thought was given to the genuine quality of its peace. Immanuel Kant's raw, homemade weave of thought had indeed proven itself to be highly durable, but it did not appeal to a broader public. It was necessary to take account of the modern taste of bourgeois democracy. The cloth of the peace flag was tie-dyed, its white threadbare weave brightly patterned, and given all the signs and symbols, it was difficult, this will be found to be corroborated, for the green of hope to stand out from the bellicose red of the lobster, the blue of faithfulness from the drab brown of the roast turkey. In such a form, this renovated weave of a pacifism in all the colors of the world's ways, which was sated in other ways too, was to be unveiled before the international public," end quote. All that was necessary, he goes on to suggest, was to find the traveling salesman who had all the necessary gesticulations, gestures, and rhetoric to promote his newly dressed commodity. This is thoroughly true of Mr. von Unruh, he tells us, who in 1922, as a traveling salesman going from city to city for eternal peace, processed the Paris position. Of course, and this was accordingly so apt that Mr. von Unruh himself bridled at moments, in German, Unruh means unrest, his import into French circles some years at Verdun did not occur without furor, not without commotion, not without the spilling of blood. Be that as it may, the report that he presents, Wings of Nike, The Book of a Journey, implies that his contact with his customer base has persisted, even when he presented for inspection peace commodities rather than heavy munitions. It is not equally as certain whether it can be assured that the publication of this travel journal, a list of his customers and done deals, is of broader use to the broader course of business. For barely had it occurred before the commodity ban began to be returned from Paris, end quote. What follows is Benjamin's analysis, entirely coincident with Pollon's own analysis, of the complicity between the rhetoric of peace and war, an analysis that takes the form of a sarcasm that often matches and even exceeds the satirical force of Kant's own text. As he writes, it is extremely instructive to examine Mr. von Unruh's pacifism more closely. Since the supposed convergence of the moral idea and that of right, on whose presupposition the European proof of the Kantian gospel of peace rested, began to disconnect in the mind of the 19th century, German peace has pointed more and more to metaphysics as the place of its foundation. The German image of peace emanates from metaphysics. In contrast to this, it has long been observed that the idea of peace in West European democracies is a thoroughly worldly, political, and in the final instance, juristically justifiable one. Pax is for them the ideal of international law. To this corresponds, in practical terms, the instrument of the arbitration court and its treaties. The great moral conflict of an unlimited and reinforced right to peace with an equitable peace, the diverse ways in which this theme has been instrumentalized in the course of history, are not up for discussion in Mr. von Unruh's pacifism, just as indeed the world historical events of this hour remain unaddressed. Mr. von Unruh has heroically wrestled himself free from reality. In any case, the great formal dinners are the only international facts that his new pacifism takes into account. His new international is hatched in the peace of the communal digestion, and the gala menu is the Magna Carta of the future peace of nations. And just as a cocky sidekick might smash a valuable vessel at a love feast, so the thin terminology of the Königsberg philosopher dispatches to the devil with a kick of a jackboot, and what remains is the innerness of the heavenly eye in its attractive alcoholic glassiness. The image of the gifted blabbermouth with a teary look, as Shakespeare alone could capture, the great prose of all evangelists of peace speaks of war. To stress one's own love of peace is always the close concern of those who have instigated war. But he who wants peace should speak of war. He should speak of the past one, and above all, he should speak of the coming one. He should speak of its threatening plotters, its powerful causes, its terrifying means. And yet this would be perhaps the only discourse against which the salons, which allowed Mr. von Unruh entry, remain completely hermetically sealed. The much-pleaded peace, which is already in existence, proves, when seen by daylight, to be the one, the only eternal known to us, that those in joy who have commanded in war and who wish to set the tone at the peace party, end quote. If Proudhon, Benjamin, and even Kant insist on the dissolution of the distinction between peace and war, this dissolution is perhaps more legible than ever before. In the current war on terror, for example, the destabilization of the distinction between war and peace now seems a given. As Alain Badiou has suggested, the category of war has become so obscured that longstanding capitalists can be bombed without informing anyone of the fact that war has been declared. As such, he writes, the continuity of war is slowly established, whereas in the past, declaring war would, to the contrary, have expressed the presence of a discontinuity. Already, this discontinuity has rendered war and peace indistinguishable, end quote. In the end, he goes on to say, these American wars are not really distinguishable from the continuity of peace, end quote. Echoing Foucault, Antonio Negri and Eric Alize similarly suggest that peace appears to be merely the continuation of war by other means, adding that because peace, otherwise known as global war, is a permanent state of exception, war now presents itself as peacekeeping and thereby has reversed its historical relation to peace. Following Agamben, Slavoj Žižek remarks, in a longer but entirely pertinent passage, that we no longer have wars in the old sense of a regulated conflict between sovereign states in which certain rules apply, to do with the treatment of prisoners, the prohibition of certain weapons, etc. Two types of conflict remain. Struggles between groups of Homer Sacher, ethnic-religious conflicts which violate the rules of universal human rights, do not count as wars proper, and call for a humanitarian pacifist intervention on the part of the Western powers, and direct attacks on the U.S. or other representatives of the new global order, in which case, again, we do not have wars proper, but merely unlawful combatants resisting the forces of universal order. In this second case, one cannot even imagine a neutral humanitarian organization like the Red Cross mediating between the warring parties, organizing an exchange of prisoners, and so on, because one side in the conflict, the U.S.-dominated global force, has already assumed the role of the Red Cross, in that it does not perceive itself as one of the warring sides, but as a mediating agent of peace and global order, crushing rebellion and simultaneously providing humanitarian aid to the local population. This weird coincidence of opposites reached its peak when Harald Nesvik, a right-wing member of the Norwegian parliament, proposed George Bush and Tony Blair as candidates for the Nobel Peace Prize, citing their decisive role in the war on terror. Thus, the Orwellian motto, war is peace, finally becomes reality, and military action against the Taliban can be presented as a way to guarantee the safe delivery of humanitarian aid. We no longer have an opposition between war and humanitarian aid. The same intervention can function at both levels simultaneously. The toppling of the Taliban regime is presented as part of the strategy to help the Afghan people oppressed by the Taliban. As Tony Blair said, we may have to bomb the Taliban in order to secure food transportation and distribution. Unquote. The distinction between war and peace always has been blurred, and this blurring belongs to a liberalism that often has instrumentalized the language of peace within the context of international law. As Nicolaus has explained, this is why to accept the idea that there was a classical age in which the distinction between war and peace made sense is to accept one of liberalism's major myths, one which circulates widely in academic discourse as part of the liberal peace hypothesis that peace is the focal dynamic of civil society, that the state exists in order to realize this liberal peace within civil society, and that international law exists to ensure peace between states. In this view, war is an exception to peace. As a myth, this has served to gloss over liberalism's own tendency to carry out systematic violence and to call it peace. To gloss over, that is, the violence of the liberal peace. End quote. This is particularly the case today when this violence is carried out in the name of peace and security. The aim of the war on terror, is peace and security, and this argument is used to justify offensive as well as defensive war. Articulated as a key principle in the emerging law of nations, the permanent colonial wars that gave rise to this law of nations increasingly took on the ideological form of peace, and as Foucault suggests, this was a key moment in the development and structural transformation of the state. The prolonged cumulative effect of new weapons technology, new disciplinary provisions, fortifications, an increase in the size of armies and navies, and the changes in tactics and strategy which these developments aided and abetted, including a fiscal centralization necessary to sustain these developments, has meant that not only was the development of the state machine accelerated as the monarchs and republics of Europe centralized and nationalized, most notably in the major colonizing powers of England, Spain, the Netherlands, and France, but it was being accelerated as a war machine. The discourse of peace came to permeate the discourse of war in the very century in which war was being treated as an ineradicable feature of politics, as a necessity for the security of the state, and in which the permanent war machine was being perfected. As Nicolaus has argued, the war machine is a peace machine. The peace machine is a war machine. Permanent war is normalized as peace. What is connoted by the word pax is not simply an absence of conflict or the making of a pact, but the imposition of hegemony achieved through conquest and maintained by arms, end quote. This is why we should remember the goddess Pax often has been portrayed with her right foot on the neck of a vanquished foe. It is because peace never appears alone, and much less in an eternal form. It never appears without the war and violence underneath its surface, and without which even a peace treaty could never get articulated, which is why it must be renewed again and again. As Kant puts it, the state of peace among men who live alongside each other is no state of nature. Rather, it is a state of war that constantly threatens, even if it is not actually in progress. Therefore, the state of peace must be founded, end quote. This is why he states later in the essay that eternal peace is a task that has to be repeated endlessly. As Blanchot would put it in his essay, Peace, Peace Far and Near, written for the catalog that accompanied an exhibition in the summer of 1985 in Paris and devoted to art from the Bible to the present. Justice demands and calls for ever more justice in me, outside of me, and in justice itself, thus also in the knowledge and exercise of justice, all of which presupposes what we could call the tragic imbroglio of the other and others, hence the intervention of the social and the political, under the guarantee of the law, in the service of all that is far, first of all, and all that is near. The redoubling of the word peace may come from here, so that this last word may be deepened as an echo of itself in an incomparable repetition. End quote. It is because peace is always far and near at the same time, always never simply itself, that it demands a vigilance that can only come by understanding that it appears, as Kant knew so well, only at its death. Peace is death, eternally and without rest, that is to say, eternally in a state of unruh. Thank you.